Here on BBC Radio 4 FM, it's our Book of the Week. Deep, by the American journalist James Nestor, is an exploration of the extraordinary world of free diving, in which swimmers dive deep underwater without oxygen or scuba gear. In the final episode, Nestor goes in search of the world's largest predator. It's read by William Hope.
I have 8 weeks before the sperm whale mission in Sri Lanka. I've been lured into the trip by Fabrice Schnoller. I first met him during a shark tagging operation on the island of Réunion, where he is based. When we last met, he mentioned that he was planning an expedition to record sperm whale clicks with some new equipment that he hopes will help with his research. "You should join the team," he said. I accepted. But I can't go if I haven't learned to free dive. In the short time since I discovered free diving, I've learnt basic safety, depth, and breath hold techniques in Greece, and I've taken free diving lessons in Florida in a freshwater swimming hole where I made it down to about 30 feet. But to dive with sperm whales, I'll have to go deeper. So I must practice. A lot. So, a few times a week, I bike down to a local public pool to swim underwater laps beneath the dangling feet of elderly women. The pool lifeguard takes it upon himself to start coaching me. His torture device of choice is an orange safety cone that he moves along the edge of the pool, forcing me to hold my breath a few seconds longer with each progressive dive. I call it subaquatic schadenfreude because making these longer dives isn't easy, and the lifeguard knows it. The drill works. After a month, I double my underwater distance. So I tell myself, and then I tell ocean researcher Fabrice Schnoller, that I'm ready. A month later, I've joined the research team in Trincomalee, on the northeast coast of Sri Lanka, to swim with sperm whales. These creatures are the world's deepest diving animals, but the only way to film and study them is to observe them when they're in shallower waters. Hunting down whales and forcing your presence on them never works. They get spooked and dive, or they attack. The whales must choose to come to you. And they'll choose a free diver more often than a boat, a scuba diver, or a robot. Sperm whale clicks, which are used for echolocation and communication, can be heard several hundred miles away, and possibly around the globe. These are the loudest animals on Earth. Their echolocation clicks could not only blow out human eardrums from hundreds of feet away, but, some scientists estimate, vibrate a human body to death. I can't wait to go looking for them. Our first two outings are a disaster. We spend hours juddering around the ocean without seeing any whales. During the off hours, we free dive. My other companion, free diving coach Hunley Prinsloo, suggests we do some depth work. After our initial meeting at a freediving competition in Greece, most of what I've learned about basic safety, depth, and breath hold techniques has come from her, and she knows just how hard my training has been. "How deep do you want to go?" she asks me. 50 feet? The water conditions today are perfectly clear. I've practiced. I've trained. I think I'm ready. I take one last inhale and descend. Soon, I've passed 20 feet and I'm falling more quickly. It gets easier the deeper I go. I'm able to loosen my grip so that I'm pulling the rope with just the thumb and forefinger of each hand. I continue to lunge downward. I bring my arms down to my sides in skydiver pose and prepare to fall into deeper water. My lungs push up toward my throat. The huge breath I took at the surface has disappeared. I didn't exhale it, but it's now compressed to half its volume, so that it tugs at the soft tissues of my lungs and throat. The feeling is unexpectedly warming, I've overcome my dry land breathing instincts, using a reflex we humans don't even know exists until we have to use it. Swedish researcher Per Hollander called this half-remembered ability the master switch of life, and I've finally done it. I've just flipped the master switch. I pull on the rope now with both hands and kick my fins with more force. I look skyward and see the reflective sheen of surface water. My head breaks through, and I'm breathing in fresh air. Prinsloo's been watching the whole dive. She doesn't say anything. She doesn't congratulate me or ask how deep I've dived. Without saying a word, we breathe up, upturn our bodies, then, together, fall back down past the doorway to the deep. On the third day's whale search, the boat captains arrived to take us out in two beat-up fishing boats with wooden planks for seats. We'll head out together to a spot where the sea floor drops off to a depth of more than 6,000 feet. We'll split up. Should someone on either boat spot any whales, he'll use a mobile phone to alert the other boat. We'll then trail the whales, wait for them to slow down or stop, and then get in the water with them. We set off, our rickety craft riding low in the water. Hours later, we're floating in a dead calm sea. No whales. Another hour passes, and another. Then suddenly, an electronic chirp blasts from the back of the boat. It's Schnaller calling. His team has just spotted a pod of sperm whales. The captain starts the motor, and we shoot south. Soon, we're surrounded by whales. Our team has agreed to put only two people in the water at any one time to avoid scaring off the whales. I'm on the first shift with Hunley Prinsloo, who says it's not a full pod, just a mother and calf. Calves get curious around free divers, and their mothers encourage them to investigate. We quietly submerge. The visibility is mediocre. We can't see the whales in the water, but we can hear them. The blows grow louder and louder. Then the clicking begins. The water starts vibrating. We stick our heads up and see a mound 100 feet in front of us. The clicking grows louder. The mound pops up from the surface again, then disappears. The whales leave. We can hear them beneath the water, their blows softening as they drift off. Prinsloo faces me. "Whale," she says. I nod and begin to tell her how incredible the experience was. Then she shakes her head and points behind me. "No, whale." The mother and calf have returned. They're 150 feet away. "Don't move. They're watching us." The clicks now sound like jackhammers on pavement. These whales are scanning us inside and out. We watch from the surface as they exhale. They lunge toward us, hissing and blowing steam. Prinsloo grips my hand. "Trust this moment," and she pulls me a few feet beneath the surface. A hazy black mass materializes in the distance, growing larger and darker. Details emerge: a fin, a gaping mouth, a patch of white. An eye, sunk low, peers in our direction. The whales approach us head on. Then, 30 feet from colliding with us, they pull softly to the side and languorously veer left. The rhythm of the clicks shifts. I believe they are identifying themselves to us. The calf floats just in front of its mother and stares with an unblinking eye. They keep their gaze upon us as they pass within a dozen feet of our faces, shower us with clicks, then retreat slowly back into the shadows, and the ocean once again falls silent. My eye-to-eye interaction with these animals was one of the most powerful experiences I've ever had. I felt a sudden recognition. an ineffable sense of knowing that I was in the presence of something extraordinarily powerful and intelligent. This is not a scientific observation, of course, but an emotional one. Still, I believe it is as true and telling as any objective fact we may discover about these creatures. You can't get that by sitting on the deck of a boat. You need to get wet. When I started this project, my goal was to participate in as much deep-sea research as I could. I had gone as far as was humanly possible, but something in me still ached to have an experience in the unimaginably deep waters on Earth that no human can ever reach. Somehow I didn't feel my journey could be completed until I'd made some kind of connection with those ultimate depths. And now, I had an idea how I could do that. I traveled to the island of Puerto Rico. Staring down at the waters of the Puerto Rico Trench, which at its deepest drops to nearly 29,000 feet, would be equivalent to standing at the foot of Mount Everest. I wanted to feel the presence of such deep waters. I also had to make a special delivery. I called around and found a large fishing boat, captained by Jose. 20 miles out to sea, we've finally passed into the Puerto Rico Trench. He asks me, "You ready to do your thing?" and cuts the motor. He watches as I pull out a Ziploc bag containing a small white plastic container. Inside this container is a memento I'll be dropping down to the deepest zone on Earth. I jump in. Within 10 seconds, I'm falling effortlessly. I reach into my wetsuit vest and take out the container, then loosen my grip until it falls away. It spins in slow motion, drifting off until there's nothing left but a speck of white against a blue and empty space. Inside the plastic container is a digital copy of this book you've been listening to. But these words aren't traveling to some distant alien world. I know now that there's nothing empty about these waters that surround me. I imagine the container touching down silently on the sea floor, where it will stay for the next few thousand years. The sea is where all life began billions of years ago, and where all living things will eventually return. And meanwhile, the farther human beings descend into the depths, the closer we will get to understanding our origins and the way we view life and our place within it. In a world of 7 billion people, where every inch of land has been mapped, developed, and too much of it destroyed, the sea remains the final untouched and undiscovered wilderness and the last quiet place on Earth. The ocean truly is the planet's last great frontier.
William Hope was reading Deep by James Nestor. It was abridged and produced by Pippa Vaughan and was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 4. Sexual abuse in the elderly, child labour, and how long should you wait before getting married? Woman's Hour tackles those issues and more in a couple of minutes after the news. First, a word from Gordon Carrera.
The late Swedish writer Stieg Larsson is most famous for his crime novels, but he was also an investigative journalist who delved deep into one of his country's greatest mysteries, the assassination of Prime Minister Olof Palme in 1986. A document written by Stieg Larsson, which for years had been buried in his archive, opens up a fascinating trail, taking us into a murky world of hardliners, spies and dirty tricks teams, a trail which extends to South Africa and also to Britain. Join me, Gordon Carrera, for Document, the Palmer Assassination, here on Radio 4 on Monday at 8 p.m.